Deep in the farthest recesses of the most distant jungle lies a city. A city populated by the most mysterious, terrifying, and downright grotesque denizens ever seen by mortal eye. Here, in the darkened corners of this cavernous locale, sits an ordinary, average brick building with an innocuous, ordinary, average blinking neon sign which reads, On Air. It is here where each week, Seth Breedlove and Mark Matzke convene to discuss the greatest mysteries the world has ever known. Now, strap on your hiking boots, grab your trusty walking stick, and don't forget your machete as we begin our journey through Monsteropolis.
This is Monsteropolis, a show about legends. I forgot what the show is about for a second. A show about legends, anomalies, and monsters. I'm one of your hosts. My name is Seth Breedlove. I'm joined by my pal,
Mark Matzke. Nice to be here.
Yeah, we got to come up with a way of introducing you that makes more sense than me just saying something and then like waiting for you to say, hey. So anyway, this week we are...
I can use the Bigfoot language.
No, please don't. We are
highly controversial.
We're in the throes of our February Valentine's Month episodes where we're discussing things we love. And so this episode is going to be about probably my favorite aspect of ufology, which is the 1940s, 1950s, Cold War era investigative aspect of this, of the phenomena. We talked about Project Blue Book already. And I alluded to the fact that the Majestic 12 is like one of my favorite aspects of all of this. So,
yeah,
so
I'm interested to hear your take on the whole MJ-12.
I don't have one. I don't know if it's a hoax or not. All I know is that purely from a storytelling standpoint, it is riveting. Mm. Like it is really riveting stuff. You know, like when you get it, when you introduce the fact that it probably is a hoax into it, it still stays riveting, because then you're like, well, who hoaxed it? Who's behind it?
Yeah.
You know, like, what does the government actually have anything to do with it? So but last night I watched a very extensive lecture. It was just a lecture. And I'm sorry, but I do not know who. Oh, dear. Why is it talking? Right. Is that you? Oh, that's you.
That is?
Yeah. What was that?
Oh, it's Alexa.
That's Alexa. She's joining us.
Why is she?
She can't get on the internet. I watched this very extensive interview that was all about now I'm blanking on the guy's name. Forrestal. James Forrestal,
okay.
Who was a member of the Majestic 12. And that's something. The Majestic 12 is typically talked about in very broad terms where we don't get down to the minutiae of who these men were that were actually supposedly involved, and you know, what happened to them and what did they say about this, and if any of them said anything about it. So
is Forrestal the one who lost
suicided himself?
Yeah.
So we're going to talk about that actually. I'll probably spend some time on that because I know a lot more about the actual circumstances surrounding his death. This was from the lecture I watched was from a MUFON symposium, and I recognized the speaker, but I cannot remember his name now, and I didn't write it down last night for some reason.
Was it Stanton Friedman?
It was not Stanton.
Okay.
No, it wasn't Stanton. It wasn't a lot of the people I know just by looking at them. So Majestic 12. We can probably do this intro together because you, as usual, have a book in front of you while I just have some notes I scrawled on my phone. But the Majestic 12 grew out of Project Sign, which we discussed as part of the Project Blue Book episode. Let me think of the right way to introduce this, actually, because to go there probably would not be completely forthright. So the Majestic 12 in the 1980s, do you have the year that the...
I think it's 84.
1984. Two researchers found a package, if I'm not mistaken, left on their doorstep or something like that, essentially, that contained documents claiming to be from a shadowy organization within the government known as the Majestic 12. And these would have been, I'll read you the Wikipedia, in UFO conspiracy theories, Majestic 12 is the code name of an alleged committee of scientists, military leaders, and government officials formed in 1947 by an executive order by U.S. President Harry Truman to facilitate recovery and investigation of alien spacecraft. The concept originated in a series of supposedly leaked secret government documents first circulated by ufologists in 1984. Upon examination, the Federal Bureau of Investigation declared the documents to be completely bogus, and many ufologists consider them to be an elaborate hoax. Majestic 12 remains popular among some UFO conspiracy theorists, and the concept has appeared in pop culture, including television, film, and literature. Stanton Friedman would be one of the people who still believes that they are factual, though I don't believe he believes they are 100% factual. I believe he thinks aspects, certain pages, some of the details are accurate. And even what I was reading about and learning last night is that they have managed to corroborate some details that are in the reports, like meetings that are said to take place within the notes that actually did take place. Keep in mind, a lot of these things that are corroborated, or all the things that are corroborated, were already public knowledge when these notes were dropped off at Jamie Shandera.
Yeah.
And
I think
And I can't remember who the other...
Jaime Shandera.
Jaime.
And, I've got the other one. Somewhere. William Elmore.
So anyway, one thing I did discover is that during that time, people believe there were conspiracy theories specifically, but they believe that there were a ton of alien crafts that had crashed and been recovered around the same time. And I actually am going to pull up another note here. I'm on the ATS forums, Above Top Secret forums, and this is the context in which one of these, what you would call a conspiracy theorist, lays out, William Cooper. So just to set the stage, if you want to go down the rabbit trail of believing that these documents, that the Majestic 12 actually existed, that this is all real, this is the context in which you would be framing it. During the years following World War II, the government of the United States was confronted with a series of events which were to change beyond prediction its future, and with it the future of humanity. These events were so incredible that they defied belief. A stunned President Truman and his top military commanders found themselves virtually impotent after having just won the most devastating and costly war in history. It goes on to talk about how basically the U.S. had positioned itself as the global superpower at that point. Following World War II, we were the richest country in the world. We were on top of the atomic arms race, all of that. But the United States government discovered that an alien spacecraft piloted by insect-like beings from a totally incomprehensible culture had crashed in the desert of New Mexico. Between January 1947 and December 1952, at least 16 crashed or downed alien craft, 65 alien bodies, and one live alien were recovered. An additional alien craft had exploded, and nothing was recovered from that incident. Of these incidents, 13 occurred within the borders of the United States, not including the craft, which disintegrated in the air. Of these 13, one was in Arizona, 11 New Mexico, one in Nevada, three occurred in foreign countries. It goes on and dissects all the various beliefs regarding all these supposed alien craft or that crashed around the country. And regardless of what you think of that kind of stuff, it at least would be worth noting that the government was looking into UFOs at the time. You don't have to go down the rabbit trail of believing that there were, what did I just say, like 60 craft that had crashed around, like 60 alien bodies recovered, yeah, and all this stuff. But certainly, if you are a conspiracy theorist and you do believe that, it even further probably pushes you into the camp of believing that Majestic 12 was a real government organization run by So is it 12 members? Is that why we're calling it 12?
Yes,
it is,
there
right?
are 12.
Okay. Do you want to go right to talking about who these men are, or do you have something to get to before that?
No, that would be perfect.
Okay, so who were the Majestic 12? And like I said, this is you've got it in front of you, mm-hmm. so you're going to be able to fill this in just as well. Why don't you do it then? Because otherwise I feel like I'm the only one talking.
Okay. All right. The members of Majestic 12 that are named, and I think this is obviously one of the compelling parts of the story, because these are real people that you can point to and create biographies about. The first is Admiral Roscoe Hillenketter, from 1947 to 1950, director of the Central Intelligence Service of the USA and first director of the newly founded CIA. The second member was Dr. Vannevar Bush.
Can I just add something to each of these two, just so I can interject for a second? Hillenketter was also, in addition to serving as director of the CIA, he was also tasked with helping invade South Korea, initiating the Korean War, and was held responsible by some for the failure to predict the hostile intentions of North Korea. Mm. The reason I think that's important, and this just kind of came to me like last night as I was watching that lecture, is these typically when you get into the UFO conspiracy theory stuff that involves people, you know, like when actual names are being mentioned, they aren't people that are very influential or powerful, which is the exact opposite of the Majestic 12. Mm-hmm. These guys are all top of the class CIA, Air Force, Navy, intelligence. Like, it's pretty crazy.
Yeah. As connected as you could possibly be.
Yeah.
You know?
I mean, Forrestal was at the top. Mm-hmm. When he committed suicide, the thing I learned last night is when I'm jumping ahead there, but when Forrestal commits suicide, it was almost like when John F. Kennedy was shot for a lot of people.
Mm-hmm.
That was a huge incident because he was the Secretary of Defense, if I'm not mistaken.
Right.
I mean, it's as highly ranked as you can get these guys involved in this.
Yeah. All right. So the second was Dr. Vannevar Bush, chairman of the National Defense Research Commission, Office of Scientific Research and Development during the war from 1939 to 1941. He was chairman of the National Advisory Committee on Aeronautics, from which later NASA was derived. From 1945 to 1948, chairman of the Joint Research and Development Board. In 1949, Bush was asked by the Intelligence Services Board to work out a way to coordinate the work of the various intelligence services effectively at the insistence of Secretary Forrestal. It was his task to coordinate the scientific investigations of alien technology, or so it is alleged.
Mm-hmm. Hillenketter, I'm sorry to jump back to this, but this is interesting. Hillenketter was a member of NICAP, and Donald Kehoe writes in his book Aliens from Space that Hillenketter wanted public disclosure of UFO evidence. He had his best-known statement on the UFO subject was in 1960. He said, behind the scenes, high-ranking Air Force officers are soberly concerned about UFOs, but through official secrecy and ridicule, many citizens are led to believe that unknown flying objects are nonsense. So we know that guy was at least involved in some capacity.
Right. All right. Number three was James Forrestal, Secretary of the Navy from 1945 to 1947. First Secretary of Defense after the War Department was changed to Defense Department from 1947 to 1949. And there's lots more, of course, to be said.
Yeah, we'll get to that.
With him. Next was General Nathan Twining, Commander of the Air Materiel Command of the Army Air Force, later Air Force at Wright Field, headquarters of the Air Intelligence Corps. He was in charge of recovering and investigating crashed UFOs. So he's based at Wright Pat.
Yeah, which is obviously a big piece of the UFO puzzle, especially because that's supposedly where they carried the Roswell craft after the crash in 1947.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, that's part of the intrigue to me is, to what degree did MJ-12 and, say, like Project Blue Book coordinate, or were they kind of separate? And because I get the sense that Project Blue Book was allowed to do what it did on sort of a surface level,
mm-hmm.
and that MJ-12 was sort of
the shadowy back channels. Mm-hmm. Twining was also the guy that created Project Sign, which I didn't realize. Mm.
So it just, you know, it begs a question. It almost, it strikes me as like Blue Book was sort of
the public
allowed
face,
to be out
the
there.
The public face of ufology. Mm-hmm. Kind of like, wasn't the CIA basically a secret organization for quite a while?
Yeah, I originally that was
so like it's if you think of it as the FBI,
right? Prominent as
if you think of it as like the FBI being the public face of like the government, you know, mm-hmm. investigation, then CIA is the back channels, like killing people in the dark alleyways.
Mm-hmm.
That's the way I always thought of Majestic 12 too.
Mm-hmm. Next is General Hoyt Vandenberg, director of Central Intelligence till 1947. Then, successively Chief of Staff of the Army Air Force and the Air Force when the latter became a separate force. He was responsible for the study of aerospace and for detecting UFOs. Next, there's a lot here about Dr. Detlev Bronk. He was founder of the Science of Biophysics, Chairman of the National Research Council from 1946 to 50, President of the National Academy of Sciences from 1950 to 62, Dean of the Johns Hopkins University, President of the Rockefeller Institute for Medical Research since 1953.
The Bronk crater on the moon is named for him.
Huh. Yeah. And during the war, he was coordinator of research for the Air Medical Office. 1945, appointed member of the Scientific Advisory Committee of the Army Air Force. In 46, Advisory Board of the Navy. In 47, of the Medical Advisory Board of the Atomic Energy Commission. If reports are to be believed, he led the examination of recovered EBEs and was coordinator of biological and behavior research.
After EBEs his
being extraterrestrial biological entities.
Okay, nice. EBE.
Yeah.
EBE.
EBE. after his death, all his papers and documents were preserved at the Rockefeller Institute. Bronk was a very methodical person who kept detailed diaries.
So did Forrestal.
Yeah. He kept all correspondence, notices, dates. Apparently, this material was complete when handed over to the Institute, but if one wants to look into these papers, one finds that the diaries for 1947 are all missing.
Nice. Naturally.
Oh, and Dr. Bronk had a UFO connection. In June 1947, he was appointed member of the Scientific Advisory Committee of the Brookhaven National Laboratory, which was under the Atomic Commission's authority. In Brookhaven, a number of projects of high classification were carried out, in which paperclip scientists like John von Neumann were involved. Together with Bronk, another scientist, Professor Edward U. Condon, became a member of the committee. Dr. Condon had led an official study of UFOs at the University of Colorado, financed by the Air Force. The aim of this study was to prove that UFOs did not exist, which naturally was not successful. A third of the investigated cases remained unexplained. Mm-hmm. And I remember just in reading recently about J. Allen Hynek, he's very excited about the fact that a university was actually going to look into this. He thought that it was very promising, and it was sort of felt like it was long overdue, but you know, really didn't work out that way. And it's just, it's, and again, intriguing to see just one step removed from that is you know, Bronk, who is well known to Condon. All right, next is Dr. Jerome Hunsaker. He was the leading aeronautic expert of the U.S. and tested innumerable forms of aircraft in the wind tunnel he had invented for their aerodynamics. During the First World War, the MIT graduate served as an engineer for the construction of the first warplanes of the U.S. Navy. When the U.S. got possession of wrecked Zeppelins, Hunsaker's team was able to study them and build the first American Zeppelin, the Shenandoah, in 1923. In 1921, Hunsaker was appointed chief designer of the newly established Office of Aeronautics. From 1933 to 51, he was the chairman of the Department of Mechanical and Aeronautical Engineering at MIT. In 1941, he was made coordinator of research for the Navy, which made him a member of the Board of the Research and Development. In addition, from 41 to 58, he was a member of the Board of Directors of NACA, the staff of which he increased from 650 to 6,500, and also initiated the building of the laboratories at Langley, Ames, and Lewis. He allegedly carried out the technical evaluation of recovered UFOs.
It seems like, is that everyone?
No.
Okay, I was going to say, it seems like as I'm doing my moderate amount of research on this one, that this organization, whereas Project Blue Book was very much like looking into UFO sightings, it got into the really weird stuff. So like the radio communication that supposedly went on, bodies that were uncovered, crash recovery, stuff like that. Whereas Project Blue Book was like, someone had a sighting here, let's go look into that.
Right. Yeah, exactly. And that's the astonishing thing about MJ-12, mm-hmm. is that it's far beyond, do UFOs exist?
They do exist.
Yeah. We're tasked with picking up what's left and figuring out what this all means.
Right.
If it's true, it goes well beyond.
And this is why I've always felt like this is just ripe to be turned into something.
Oh, yeah.
Like this is my comic coming to life, mm-hmm. here. So yeah. At some point I got to do this.
Yep. Okay. Next is Sidney Sowers, first director of Central Intelligence, then executive secretary of the National Security Council from 47 to 50, also special consultant to President Truman in Secret Service Affairs. He was coordinator for internal security. Next was Gordon Gray, Assistant Secretary of the Army, War Secretary from 1949 to 50, then Special Consultant to Truman for National Security Affairs, Chairman of the CIA's Top Secret Psychological Strategic Board. Chief of the Civil Operations Department of MJ-12, he was responsible for propaganda and the maintenance of public ignorance about ET activities. In this capacity, he developed the quote-unquote strategy of banalizing, the aim of which was to reduce public interest in UFOs by ridiculing the witnesses and inventing far-fetched explanations.
He was security advisor to Dwight Eisenhower, too, which would have been later. That was 58 to 61, and served on the President's Foreign Intelligence Advisory Board under President John F. Kennedy, Lyndon Johnson, Richard Nixon, and Gerald Ford. Just kept going.
Yeah.
Publisher of the Winston-Salem Journal, chairman of the board of the Piedmont Publishing Company, and chairman of the National Trust for Historic Preservation.
The next that's mentioned, and this is super brief in this particular spot, but is extremely controversial in a way, is Dr. Donald Menzel.
Yeah.
Professor of Astrophysics at Harvard from 1939 to 71, chairman of the Department of Astronomy, 46 to 49, and dealt with issues regarding natural sciences and the scientific community, as it says here, but really was thought of in many circles as a debunker.
Yeah. Co-authored or co-authored three popular books, Debunking UFOs, Flying Saucers, The World of Flying Saucers, A Scientific Examination of a Major Myth of the Space Age, and the UFO Enigma, the Definitive Explanation of the UFO Phenomenon. And those were written over the course of almost two decades, 53, 63, and 1977, that he published those three works where he debunked UFOs. In 1968, Menzel testified before the U.S. House Committee on Science and Astronautics Symposium on UFOs, stating that he considered all UFO sightings to have natural explanations. Kind of flies in the face of a guy who's dissecting alien bodies behind closed doors. But that's, again, like, if you believe. So we've established who these men are. We need to talk about.
There's a few more.
Oh, geez. How do you have so many more than I do?
Well, we're on MJ-11.
Okay. All right. Let's hit
there's him. 11, 12, yeah. And then the guy who replaced Forrestal.
Okay. Oh, interesting.
Yeah.
No, I didn't get that far.
Oh, and in regard to Menzel, I seem to recall, you know, he and Hynek going toe-to-toe, mm-hmm. on more than one occasion.
Cool.
Because Menzel's completely default was debunking, like you said. Mm-hmm. And Hynek, I feel for that guy so much, because it seems to me he was just so purely scientific in the sense of really wanting to evaluate the data, and he kept running into people with... you know, vested interest or like biases to like Menzel seems to be just go explain everything in terms of natural causes for the sake of the cover up.
Mm-hmm.
And there's Hynek just trying to do his best, but and then he ends up getting accused of the same thing.
Yeah,
he couldn't win. But all right, so then there's Dr. Lloyd Berkner, geophysicist, executive secretary of the Joint Research and Development Board from 46 to 47 under Dr. Vannevar Bush. He headed a special commission that led to the establishment of the Weapons Systems Evaluation Group. His job was to develop defense strategies against unknown intruders. It's interesting to note that since the early 20s, he had been working on long-distance radio wave transmission and geomagnetism. First field was relevant for establishing contact with aliens, the infamous SETI, a search for extraterrestrial intelligence. Berkner was one of the scientists who developed the radar and early warning systems, as stated in an FBI memorandum. High-powered radar caused the UFOs to crash. He built up the military protection system of the aerospace. It is indisputed that Berkner dealt with UFOs. He was a member of the so-called Robertson Panel of the CIA, an advisory panel on UFOs, which met at the Pentagon from January 14th to 18th, 1953. At this meeting, an educational program which would result in reduction of public interest in flying saucers and should have two major aims, training and debunking. Finally, then, the last of the 12 was Major General Robert Montague, from July 47 to February 51, commander of the Atomic Energy Commission's base at Sandia, New Mexico, which controlled White Sands Proving Grounds. As MJ-12, he was partly liaison officer for contact with the AEC, which possessed some of the best laboratories of the county, I think that means probably country, amongst them Los Alamos. And then you have General Walter B. Smith, who took over when Secretary Forrestal committed suicide. He was second director of the CIA. As Eisenhower's chief of staff during the war, he contributed considerably towards the victory in Europe. As U.S. ambassador in Moscow from 1948 to 49, he knew Stalin personally, which was an advantage in his new work, for he could act as contact man for the Eastern Bloc. When Jaime Shandera received the document, all the original members of the MJ-12 group had died, most recently Jerome Hunsaker, only a few weeks before.
Like I said, I watched this whole lecture on Forrestal last night. It was super interesting. So his career was so distinguished, it's kind of crazy, because like he owned a house that eventually was bought up by Irving Berlin and like all this stuff. But he was a philanderer, like him and his wife both were. She wasn't even with him when he died. She was in Paris. So like they, you know, there was a lot of things about it that reminded me of like Kennedy. Or the Kennedys, but his death. So the way all that started, the mental breakdown and all that started, is there was a change in office coming, and he worked for Truman, Department of Defense. Is that what it was? Let me run back up and find Forrestal real quick. We're talking about Forrestal. So how did I lose this? Where did this go? Forrestal. The riveting listening.
Yeah, Secretary of the Navy Secretary of Defense, okay. After first the War Secretary Department was changed to the Defense.
That's what it was. So, and he was going to lose that position. And he became very paranoid. He told people that he everyone was out to get him and all this stuff. He also kept very, very precise journals, diaries on everything that happened. He has a mental breakdown. They put him in this hospital, and he's in the hospital for a couple months, I believe. And in that time, he shows marked improvement. His brother calls to notify them that he is going to pick him up on a Sunday. I believe he called on a Friday. He's dead that night. He tells them, he calls the hospital because he had shown so much improvement. He was going to take him to a friend's estate to finish his recovery because he was pretty much back to normal. He was eating again. He gained 12 pounds. He'd lost all this weight. He would gain 12 pounds, was doing fine. When they found him, he had his bath. So supposedly he went across, he opened the door to his hallway or the door to his room, walked across the hallway into a kitchen and jumped out a window, is what they claimed. Now, the confusing thing is he had his sash for his robe wrapped around his neck. So then they said, well, he attempted to hang himself. So if you buy into what the official explanation is, he attempted to hang himself, changed his mind, and tried to crawl back in the window and fell to his death. The sash was wrapped around his neck. What was really strange is this was according to the lecture I watched last night. There was a man that was a part of the FBI team that investigated the room after the, you know, like dusted for fingerprints and all that after the death. They found palm prints down the sides of the window. So you would associate with that with someone trying to stop themselves from being thrown out of a window. And that's pretty well known, like that that's something that in the report it says that they found his palm prints on the windows as if he was being forced out of this window. He fell 16 stories and died after making a marked improvement and after like the day that his brother had said he was going to come get him, you know, at the close of the weekend. So he commits suicide that night. And up until the end, he would say to people that they were coming to get him. Someone was going to come get him. And no one quite knew what he was referring to. So Forrestal, in a lot of ways, has always been the smoking gun of Majestic 12 because it's one of those aspects of it that demands an explanation, but there doesn't seem to be one. You know, like if you went with Occam's razor, you would almost say that that is the simplest explanation. Like those two things correlate really conveniently, you know, like a very odd suicide and his name being associated with the Majestic 12. So I've always loved this entire story, like everything about the Majestic 12. And then if you want to get past all this and get more to like the 1980s and where did these documents come and who created them, if it is a hoax, do you like what's like where do you stand on all this, and maybe lay out for the listeners like why people believe these are unfortunately probably a hoax?
Well, some of that has to do with the way that the documents themselves appear. Now people like Stanton Friedman have done extensive work on
like a key on the key on the typewriter that only would have been in. Is that right?
That's right. And even like details as to what type of typewriters would have been present in the White House, and how easy would it have been to reproduce that, the signature, you know, Truman's signature, the type of language that was used, the spacing that would have been typically used in order to, you know, create a document and then walk into the president's office and have him sign it. I mean, there's lots of little minutiae that seems to argue for them being a fairly legitimate documents. Mm-hmm. That's part of what makes it so intriguing. There, once in a while, you know, people will say they didn't number cases the way that they appear, although that's been explained as not a case number, but a date, way of showing a date instead. So I don't know. I mean, I haven't looked into that closely, but
the fact that the FBI is denying that this is legitimate means nothing. Like I think no matter what they would do that, they would do that if this was
sure,
if this was real or not. So like I've pretty much thrown that out, but I am very curious about like what other, especially ufologists, because ufologists would want to believe that this is real because it basically is sort of like the proof that UFOs and aliens and crash recovery and all that kind of stuff has actually taken place. But regardless of whether or not it's true, this entire thing is really fascinating. And it's also kind of cool to learn about people you'd never heard of. Like I never heard of a lot of these people, especially Forrestal. And Forrestal's, his personal story is so interesting to me, especially after watching what I watched last night was 98% his personal history. Nothing about UFOs or any of that. And then at the end, it got into the stranger aspects of his suicide, his quote-unquote suicide, so, which I fully believe was not a suicide after.
What did they suggest was the reason for his untimely death? Did they get into
Well, it would have been... It was pretty clear he would have... He was either going to spill the beans on the fact that, you know, the Majestic 12 thing, or if you throw out the Majestic 12 aspect of the story, it could have been that he was aware of the Roswell crash. It could have been, you know, like it could have been any number of different things that were taking place at that time in ufology, or it could have been the fact that he knew some state secret about Korea, or you know, like it could have been anything. Maybe he had plans to the atomic bomb or something, and they wasn't supposed to have them. Mm-hmm. Like it could have been anything, but the idea that it was a suicide, it just doesn't make sense as far as like the way he would have killed himself, and then the fact that it's too convenient when he died. It's way too convenient with what was actually taking place with his recovery.
So. Tell me again how he ended up in the hospital. Was it a mental breakdown?
It was. So he had a mental breakdown. They said he'd grown increasingly paranoid and basically had a nervous collapse. And this was a guy who was always very in control. If you look at pictures of him, especially during college, like he was a very attractive guy. He kept everyone at arm's length, though, including his wife, who also kept him at arm's length. In fact, she shows up after his death and just goes along with the official report and the hospital report. She says, you know, there's nothing suspicious about any of this. And I forget, there were reasons as to why she might have done that beyond just wanting to cover up, you know, beyond just wanting to get out of it and go back to Paris. She didn't, seemingly from what I could find, she wouldn't have really cared. So they had a very cold marriage from sounds of things. But a really interesting character. I would actually suggest people go look into Forrestal because he seems to be, just regardless of whether or not UFOs, you know, are a thing, or he was a part of Majestic 12, he was a fascinating historical figure.
Yeah, there's an incredible story there, just on a personal level.
Yeah.
You know, I think the other thing that is so cool to consider is the other documents that were involved, not just the list of names, but stuff like the Special Operations Manual.
Yeah.
You know, Extraterrestrial Entities and Technology Recovery and Disposal. I mean, to that level of detail.
You can find all of this online in a downloadable PDF. It's on my old iPad. Every page of it, every page of the Majestic 12 documents are online in a PDF.
Yeah.
And I would recommend going to look at them, because if this is a hoax, it is an extremely well-orchestrated hoax that would have required massive amounts of time and commitment to put together. And that's one of the things that's so interesting about it. You almost have to believe, if it is a hoax, it might actually be a hoax perpetrated by the U.S. government.
Right.
Which then begs the question of why.
Mm-hmm.
Just leaving that hang there for listeners to consider. But yeah, this was one of my favorite stories, and it's one of the things that I've always been super fascinated with. So do you want to wrap us up on Majestic 12?
I think that I'm very compelled to learn as much as I can about it, because I don't know enough. I know enough to be extremely interested, and I really want to dig into what Stanton Friedman's conclusions actually are, because he's put decades of research into it, it seems like. And I guess I don't have anything, you know, too unique to say about it, except I agree completely with the idea that if it is true, it's the bombshell story of the past two centuries. And if it's a hoax, it's the most interesting hoax ever perpetrated, in terms of the level of detail and reality. It's crazy. And if it, like you said, if it is the government doing it to itself, I mean, that level of disinfo or misinfo or whatever you would call it is really astonishing, and begs the question, what are we being thrown off the trail of, if it's not alien craft crashing on Earth, and what, you know, what are we being misdirected away from?
If you like the show, leave us a rating or review on iTunes, visit us on Facebook or Twitter, and don't forget to back the Kickstarter if you're a Small Town Monsters fan who wants to support the films we're making. Get stuff through the campaign, which is active through March 9th. So thanks for listening.
Monsteropolis is proudly presented on Wadsworth Community Radio 97.1 FM or streaming live at wadsworthcommunityradio.com. It is proudly underwritten by Thurber's Jewelers on the Square in downtown Wadsworth.